Hello, and welcome to Building Our Future, the podcast where we meet the people shaping the way we design, construct, and utilize our built environment. Well, the big news here this week is that I have bitten the bullet and finally signed up to Twitter. My handle is @building_r, and you can follow me for episode updates, news about the podcast, and please do feel free to tweet me and get in touch with any comments, really, but also particularly interested to hear ideas that you would like explored on the show. Back to more serious matters. So over the past few weeks, we've discussed the concept of community a fair amount, both how technology and also culture can help act as catalysts in helping to create community. Now, underpinning all of this is a belief that better communities do actually make for better built environments at large. But I decided it was time to meet someone who spent some serious time thinking about why community is important, what it really means, whether it's actually relevant to real estate, and if so, how we can help nurture and develop it through the way that we plan, design, and manage our buildings. Community is arguably at its most critical within a residential setting. So it was the co-living concept, the collective, that I decided to turn to for answers. My guest today is Ed Thomas, Head of Community Experience at The Collective, the co-living and co-working property company founded in 2010 by Reza Merchant. Ed studied at Bristol University before heading to San Francisco and becoming involved in the first generation of concept living, Negev. He returned to the UK in 2016 in order to help launch The Collective's first co-living scheme, the 546-bed development in Old Oak, West London. Old Oak combines 546 micro-apartments with a gym, spa, library, co-working space, a cinema, various classes and all utility bills in a single monthly bill, ranging from £950 to £1,500 per month. The success of the site is reflected in the demand. The scheme is currently at 100% occupancy, with an average age of 28 and an annual tenant turnover of around 50%, which is fairly average for tenants of this age. On the back of the success at Old Oak, The Collective has plans to open new schemes at Stratford and Canary Wharf, as well as global expansion ambitions. Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
What you do obviously encompasses a very broad range, but I wanted to start with a quote about the concept of co-living. Co-living comes in many different forms, but it's essentially a shared living experience that tries to bring the idea of community back into the heart of home. Do you know who said that?
That was me, wasn't it?
That was you. Very wise quote from Very Wise Man.
Thank you.
No, so when I was thinking about this, I found various quotes, and this one I kept coming back to because I kept thinking about what The Collective really is at Old Oak. And as an outsider, I think it's kind of very easy to look at it and think, well, what it really is a great building. It's a series of very well-curated micro-apartments with some shared facilities, hassle-free billing system, and what have you. But I suppose if you look at it on a kind of cost basis, and which I don't think people do, but you're kind of comparing it square foot for square foot, it's relatively expensive, and yet the demand has been pretty extraordinary, so you're at 100% occupancy. So people are clearly looking at it for something beyond just the building. And that really appears to be this concept of community, and that's kind of clear in the reviews that you read of guests who've or renters who have been there. Do you think that's fair, that it really is about that element of community rather than the building itself?
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing we've learned pretty quickly is that people are not moving into Old Oak out of economic necessity. And that has really shown us and inspired us to continue pushing the envelope and on what is that kind of that piece that we're providing that is not the nice building and the hassle-free living, which to me should come as standard in this day and age. You know, I think if we can make a great living experience if we just do that alone, because the rental market in London is so poor. I mean, so many people have had, yourself probably included, and definitely me, bad rental experiences going on to spare room and it not being a good experience. So I think if we tackle that, then we've already solved one problem. And so, you know, that's kind of the low-hanging fruit for us. But I think where the real magic is and where it's really interesting and could be extremely compelling for us as a business and what we're aiming towards is that community side. You know, we want to really foster a sense of communities in home, in people's homes again. And, you know, we are on this trajectory to do that. If you think today there's fewer and fewer occasions for people to meet in community, it's more relevant than ever and seems very logical to support a new option that promotes human connection that people are lacking so desperately.
So I'd love to pick up as to how one goes about curating that environment. But before we do that, this may sound like a very obvious question, but what are the benefits of community beyond just a human need to interact with others?
So we shouldn't look over or gloss over that idea that, you know, living in communities is kind of an important thing. I think it's extremely key to our happiness. You know, social connection is key to our survival as a species. You know, let's not forget that there are lots of studies that have shown that living in isolation or being lonely is very detrimental to our health. There's a study by Brigham Young University that shows that being lonely is the equivalent of smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day. It costs the UK economy £32 billion, according to the Jo Cox Commission. We've just appointed a loneliness minister. So we are... You know, human connection is fundamental to who we are. We are social animals. And so, you know, living in community can bring a raft of benefits that we perhaps don't even know about, that don't even know that we need. You know, we are resilient. We live in London. It's kind of the city that moves very, very fast. So it's very easy to forget that we need human connection. But what comes with it is hugely beneficial, whether it's in the form of friendship, whether it's in the form of just someone supports, that support network can be hugely valuable, especially if you are in a city like London. So, you know, I think it's very, very important not to kind of gloss over the concept of living in community and living with people.
There's basically two sides to it, I suppose. There's one that if you are lonely, it's going to be detrimental to your health. And if you're living in or you're part of a vibrant network of other people, then that is not only kind of good for you, but it has a lot of kind of positive potential impacts as well. Networking opportunities.
I really like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is a kind of a way I think about what we do, which is the bottom, you've got the kind of the security, the basic needs, the safety, the good night's sleep. And we provide that really effectively and kind of as standard. But then at the top of the hierarchy of needs is the self-actualization. It's about, you know, realizing one's potential and you know, becoming the best versions of ourselves. And by living in co-living and the collective, we are able to fulfill all of those needs. And I think at the top of the pyramid of needs, where people are able to realize their full potential, it is best done when you're surrounded by people who are also trying to do the same thing. And there's that great quote, one of my favorites of all time, which is, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. If you're living in a place where the people around you are also striving to become the best versions of themselves, it can be very, very inspiring. And let's not forget, they've also got a great place to live. So you can see the benefits that living in this way can bring far beyond just having a roof over their head.
Is there any work that's been done, so this applies for co-working as well as co-living, of the benefits or not as to having similar-minded or similar types of people living or working together versus having a totally diverse industry base or whatever it may be?
I think there's pros to both. I think if you're living with like-minded people, you're going to have more in common with them straight away, and I think that can speed up the process of finding people who are like you. You're also more likely to benefit from the skills that they have because, you know, you're probably working towards the same goal. However, I think diversity is and appreciating diversity and living with different people is also a very valuable experience. You know, I can relate to my own personal experience. When I was in San Francisco, I was the only Brit living in this co-living space. I was the only one who wasn't really working in technology. I'd gone there to learn about technology. And in one of the spaces I lived in, which was only for 4 months, I learned more than the kind of year I spent doing a grad scheme in a marketing agency, digital marketing agency out there. And those were people who I'd never normally imagine living with. So, you know, I think there is this important side to co-living, which, you know, I often share, is that, you know, there's a difficult side of living in community and it's challenging at times, but often through those periods we learn the most about ourselves, and that's why it can be such a beneficial experience.
We talk about co-living being in its nascency, where I suppose the reality is all of us listening to this, co-living has probably been around for as long as any of us in some way, shape or form. We just probably knew it as a flat share. So what's really changed now is it's reached with pioneers like yourselves the kind of institutional style of scale, where you can curate a different type of community with that scale. Why do you think that this has come about now? Is this led by technology, or is this led by kind of supply-demand dynamics within the big cities?
I think there's a lot of things that are happening at the same time that make the conditions perfect for innovation and housing. I think on one hand, we have a major housing crisis where the demand is far surpassing the supply every single year. You know, we need to be building nearly 50,000 new homes a year in order to meet the demand. And that demand is only going to increase. So by 2050, 50% of the world's population will live in cities. So we need to house them, these people who want to come and live in cities somewhere. So there's, I think there's this sort of housing trend that's happening. But then also, if you look at the trends of the millennial generation, they are getting married later. They are changing jobs more frequently. They're having fewer kids. They are spending their money in different ways. There's trends moving away from models of ownership, but towards models of accessibility. And in line with that, the sharing economies, the rise of companies like Uber and Airbnb. So all these shifts in behavior are making the conditions perfect for some form of disruption in housing. Excuse me for using that word, but I do think this industry has not had a lot of disruption, and so it's about time. And it seems to be a very good time, very relevant time for this change to happen.
I suppose that there are a number of possible responses. You either build more homes and you hope that additional supply brings down pricing, or you create more kind of siloed affordable housing, but we all know that comes with problems. One of the solutions that seems to be happening is simply building smaller units, and the unit price is lower, but is that really the direction we want to be heading in? And so I think what's really interesting is you are offering this alternative approach, and the demand dynamics are quite clearly there. But in terms of supply, do you think that this is only really possible now that technology has evolved, or do you think the collective could have existed 10 years ago?
I think it could definitely have existed. In terms of our member experience, we are tech-led, definitely. But I don't think we rely on, I mean, we're providing housing, we're providing a place to live, and technology is not core to that. It's not like Uber, for instance, which is a marketplace app where you have to have two people with the app to access the market. So I don't think it's as core as something like Uber, so I wouldn't put it in that camp. But what I would say is that in some ways, the growth of tech has actually resulted in co-living, not in a more conventional sense, but I think it's because of technology we've become increasingly isolated, we've become increasingly lonely, and actually it is now we crave real connection, a real life social network. And so I would probably put together an argument to say that technology means co-living is very appropriate now, but not for the reasons you're stating.
It's the question as to the social media paradox that we're living in an ever more connected society, but only in kind of ephemeral ways. So for all the good technology is done, it seems to have raised kind of personal anxiety of people comparing themselves against, you know, the lives that they see on social media, but also where once we had to work really hard to maintain our relationships and our societal connections, I think now we've become slightly complacent and feel that a couple of tweets or a LinkedIn message here or there will be enough to maintain those relationships.
That's exactly what I believe. Listen, at the Collective, we're, you know, a young team, a young company, and I think what sets us apart is that we are very much our own market. And often I look at myself and my own experience and think, right, I actually grew up in a small village outside of London. Everyone knew everyone. It was a sort of open door policy, basically. And I've come to London and I'm part of the rat race and see how people are living and choosing their phone over choosing some message, not even pick up the phone. I mean, that's completely dead now, supposedly, I read over the weekend. But, you know, choosing to text, we're becoming flakier. You just read it online. There's some fascinating trends. And I'm not generalizing here, but, you know, the data is out there to have a look at. So we definitely live in a society where we rely a lot on technology. And I think that's one of the reasons why I care about what we do so much. You know, technology definitely makes the experience possible and adds value. For instance, we have an app for our members who can discover people who might have skills that they're looking to gain, which is a big plus, but we will always favor human-led connection.
It's an enabler for...
Exactly. It's an enabler. It's not core to why we exist.
Has technology and social media also led to a perception problem about what community really is? And I say that, and I'm sure there are people listening who can sympathize with this, that there are some really great ideas outside of Collective out there, which might be entertainment-based or what have you, where people are trying to engender a sense of community or spirit or what have you, and it just comes along a little bit forced. So you turn up to something and people are trying to group hug you. And it's that barrier between trying to let something occur naturally and the slightly kind of corny forcing it on you. How do you find that balance between getting people together and kind of leaving them to do it?
I can speak to this pretty well just because having spent time in the US in San Francisco, where there's a very different approach to community, and it is all about hugs and what they call quote cuddle puddles, and I mean it's very hippie out there, actually, to be completely honest, and I found that challenging at times. It was never on my own terms, and so when I came back to London, I thought, you know, what can we do with our own take on this experience that means it's much more on the terms of the people who are partaking in it. And a lesson we learned very fast was that curation doesn't actually work. It should not be about curation. Curation, this top down, you will do this, you will do that, this is how you'll feel, this is what you're subscribing to. You know, that does not create an authentic experience. What we need to be doing is providing the software, the kind of the both the physical architecture, but also the intangible architecture that allows community to flourish from the bottom up.
So who do you have on site?
So we have a general manager and then a team who are responsible for facilities, so keeping the water hot and the lights on. But then we have a team of seven community hosts and a community leader who are responsible for facilitating that experience. So their role is quite diverse, but they've been recruited based on their skills and the softer skills that they have in abundance, you know, empathy, the ability to connect. They're not necessarily coming from a hospitality background. You know, we've got people who are photographers, yoga instructors.
Right. But are they full-time or are they they're residents?
No, they're full-time. They're all full-time. But what they have is the ability to connect with people naturally, you know, is what they're passionate about.
They, on the show in previous weeks, we've had a number of people talking about the concept of community. So a few weeks ago, Vanessa Butts of District was on here and telling us about how her emphasis is really on providing technology to enable the creation of community, but it's really, it's down to the humans to actually do it. The technology is just a tool to help facilitate that. And it sounds, that's kind of like what you're doing as well. It's trying to make it as natural as possible and just giving people the right, A, buildings and B, tools and then on-site help to make that happen.
Yeah, so it's very similar. The difference is that this is in the real world. You know, this is the meeting place is an actual building that people are living in. And so it creates, I think, a much more vibrant community because there's people are there every day. They're interacting all the time. You know, right now, there's 546 people living in Old Oak and they call that home and they are engaging in it every single day. So it's quite groundbreaking.
The feedback element is an important one. So engaging with people to create community is one thing, but you've also got whatever it is, 550 people living in one building. It's a lot to manage. You believe in the concept of fearless feedback. Mm-hmm. How do you go about engaging with your, do you call them customers or?
They're members.
Members to kind of really understand what's going on.
Fearless feedback is actually a motto or value that I borrowed from Apple. I think it's a great approach to business. And one of the ways we're trying to separate ourselves from what's out there in terms of housing is by thinking about housing as a product and products iterate and evolve and upgrade constantly on cycles based on user feedback. And so we've started with the needs and wants of the people who are looking to live in London, and we've built something around that as opposed to the opposite way, which is what's been done for so long and results in housing that is not fit for purpose.
you are now, well, you have first mover advantage in this space. You've got two new projects on the go. Well, they're probably not new anymore, but two pipeline projects on the go. What lessons have you learned, both from the process of building, but also actually feedback from your members?
I mean, this could be 10 podcasts worth of learnings, to be honest with you. But I think a couple of key ones that come to mind straight away. I think the first one is that, you know, these things take time. You know, you can't sort of create a community like that. It takes time and effort and work to build it. So that's the first thing I think we'll go into knowing that when we launch Canary Wharf. I guess the second one is that idea I talked about earlier, which was around facilitation as opposed to curation. I think that was a really valuable lesson that we learned quite quickly. You know, people want this authentic experience. They want something that's, you know, it's a community, it's not about this top-down approach. It should be about ownership. It should be about belonging themselves, not us telling them what to do. I think another really important lesson for us and me especially was the importance in providing the basics first and doing that really, really well before you try and do anything that's slightly more bold, I suppose, with regards to, you know, the personal development piece. You know, we're finding now that people moving in are really keen for this kind of opportunity to grow and potentially launch a business themselves, learn a new skill or change out of a job they're not enjoying. But I mean, we're supporting that a lot now as one of our sort of new projects. However, we can't, it's no use pursuing that if we're not able to provide, you know, a good night's sleep, for instance. Right. And that was a really, I mean, it sounds really obvious, but that was a really steep learning curve, I think, right at the very start when we opened Old Oak.
And are you talking about soundproofing there? Or?
No, it wasn't so much soundproofing. We just, you know, no one in the team had ever launched a co-living space other than me, and I'd only done one which was a tenth of the size, so we were having to learn very, very fast, and we had no guides to work from. So it was about, you know, yeah, trying to do what felt right as quickly as possible. But you've got a brand new building. Brand new buildings are notoriously complicated. Things go wrong, and we had some issues with, you know, fire alarms, for instance, that would go off sporadically, which stopped people from getting a good night's sleep. So I can spend, you know, hours talking about how great it is living in community and all the benefits you'll get from it, but if you can't get a good night's sleep, then people don't care about that.
Sure. Building snags or issues are certainly one thing, and the other part must be management. And by that, I don't mean the facilities management. I mean the soft side of it. So where you have a lot of us would have flat shared at university and what have you, where you're sharing with other people normally your biggest problem.
Yeah,
like they can be one of the biggest benefits, but it can be a pain in the ass as well. So if you've got someone who's not doing their fair share of washing up in the kitchen, how's that dealt with?
The average age is 28, as you said. These are not people who are 18-year-olds. So straight away, we find there's a very different level of life experience of people who live there. They're not people who are there for a, you know, party all the time and getting wasted. It's not. They're much more likely to be there for reasons of, as I said, starting businesses or moving to London from another country or from another city in the UK. That doesn't mean to say that doesn't happen, don't get me wrong, but we, you know, we work very closely with the cleaning team, for instance, to ensure that kitchens are kept clean. So, you know, we're also not a hotel. We don't want people just to, you know, we don't clean up after people. Right. It's definitely not what we stand for. So part of, again, living in community is about taking responsibility and being respectful. So we really hammer that message home a lot. But, you know, as you've pointed out rightly, one person's clean is another person's dirty. And so with that in mind, we know that there's various points that we need to work on, especially in those kind of traditional pain points in flat shares we've sought to eradicate. So, you know, we clean our shared spaces every single day, and that results in a, you know, big improvement in just generally living in the community and sharing with other people.
I think the natural assumption would be that co-living would really work for people who have just left university and are used to that, and it's a natural continuation. Do you know what the full range is of ages?
75% of our members are under the age of 35, but that 25% that is not is distributed fairly equally across the decades. And I think that to me has been a really pleasant surprise, actually. Yeah. I think naturally, even myself thought, okay, this is just going to be lots of young people fresh out of university, but actually we're finding people move in across the age spectrum. Even more significantly, those people who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, as involved in the community as the people who are in their 20s and 30s. So, you know, put another way, they are hosting events, they are ambassadors, they are, you know, they actually offer some guidance to the younger people who might be looking for jobs or at apprenticeship level. So we have, you know, three people who are at the who work for the BBC as apprentices who are working closely with, you know, a 50-year-old professional photographer who lives in the building. So there's an education piece that comes with that age that I think is really, I think really compelling. It's a really compelling element of living in that. And, you know, very early on, we also saw that there's no correlation at all between satisfaction and age. So you're just as likely to enjoy living in Old Oak if you're 60 as if you are 20. So I think as we sort of develop co-living further and further, you know, we'll be thinking a lot more about how we can integrate different ages, different backgrounds, different occupations into the fabric of the community.
Is there a waiting list to get in?
There is on certain room types, yeah. So we are 99.2% occupied right now.
There'll always be a bit of churn.
There's always, exactly, always a bit of churn. So we, and we've got different room types in the building, and certain room types are big waiting list for them.
And is it first come, first served?
Yeah, exactly. So
do you have any, or would you want any control as to what type of people you're allowing in to try and maintain a diverse spread of members?
The way I think about this is, co-living is open to anyone. It's just not for everyone. So we spend quite a lot of time on our website explaining what it is and describing what the experience is like and what is expected and what the values are and how this is different from a standard flat share. Then when people come and look around Old Oak, we interview them as part of their tour, and the team who are responsible for growing our member base are very well trained in explaining to people and describing what is co-living and answering any questions that people have. Naturally, that is often a filter. You know, people will go, actually, you know what, I don't want to live with this many people. Even the website is a big filter as well. So often the people who come through the door are often people who are really interested in living like this. By the time that people are moving in, they are set on this as a living experience that would benefit them. So, you know, I think given the concept and how it's quite unique, it kind of filters itself in a way.
And the two new projects, are they going to be of a similar scale?
Canary Wharf is 705 units, so it's going to be bigger.
Okay.
And so that will be a slightly different, I think we'll attract different members given the location.
Right.
You know, we'll take a lot of the learnings across from Old Oak. You know, the team's now got 2 and a bit years of experience under our belt, which is hugely valuable. So it won't be like we're starting from square one. And I'm really excited to see how that project grows based on all that experience. Once we can connect the two communities, that's when it starts to get also really exciting, because that's one of the big benefits of living like this is the network effect.
Right.
You've got access to hundreds of people. So, you know, if someone in Old Oak might be able to benefit from a very unique skill set that someone has in Canary Wharf, then that's another value add to living in collective co-living.
I've mentioned previously that you have this first mover advantage, but there are a number of emerging new players. So WeWorks, WeLive is clearly one of the bigger names as a German brand, Medici Living. Who do you see as the future competition, and how will you seek to differentiate yourself going forward?
Any competition at this stage for us is good, because we spend a lot of time educating people. And so more people are doing co-living, not only validates the concept, but also means that the word will spread to more people. So I think that will massively benefit us. We'll have to spend much less time and resource on trying to educate people on what co-living is. In terms of who our competition will be, well, I mean, you've named some of the key people out there. How we differentiate is just by scale. You know, our model is different. We design, build, and operate the buildings, which gives us full control over the space as opposed to retrofitting existing spaces. And that's really important, because the physical hardware of the building is crucial to building communities. So, you know, we've got amazing shared spaces in Old Oak, And in-house, we have a design team that does all the fit-out, so we don't outsource any of that. So we have complete agency over what it looks like. So I think that's kind of a big way we'll differentiate. Technology will be a big part as well. So, you know, we're building out technology that will, again, improve the experience for our members, and that will be core to us being this kind of tech-enabled platform, but always retaining the kind of human-led approach. And then finally, I think it's the community that massively motivates us to, and that's how we will differentiate is on the community side. You know, this is true community.
And that's where we began the conversation, and it seems like a good place to end it, because I couldn't agree more. It's at the heart of the space as a service concept is this idea of community. And there's going to be those who are paying lip service to it and saying they've got it because people are sharing space together, and there are those that are actually proving it out and creating that real sense of community. And I'm sure in due course, sooner rather than later, that will start to be borne out in occupancy rates, retention rates, customer satisfaction, and ultimately rental values. So thank you. That's been absolutely fascinating. But we do always end up with two questions for all our interviewees. The first of which is, do you have a favourite building? I think I might know what's coming.
Old Oak would definitely be the favourite building. It's the only one we've got, but also it has a lot of personal meaning because, you know, it is the biggest of its kind in the world, and I guess it's where I've been able to put my own print in the co-living world, and without the collective I wouldn't have been able to realize my own vision without that support.
Did you join prior to the construction or during? Or
during.
So you were able to put part of your learnings from San Fran
Exactly. Then and it's I learn a lot from San Francisco. There's some amazing people out there and just an amazing culture. And it definitely showed me what was possible, but there were lots of things I didn't like about it. So it gave me that perspective that I like to think lives on in Old Oak.
And our final question is, is there any emerging themes or technology within real estate or the built environment that you've come across in your work that you're pretty excited about in the future?
So one thing we picked up quite early on in Old Oak was that people shared items with one another,
right?
Which was quite an interesting observation. We had a Facebook group, which has subsequently graduated into our app. But early on in the Facebook group, it was used for people to, you know, they would post something. Hey, does anyone have
a tennis racket
or a tent or a suitcase I can borrow? And we saw this as a great opportunity. And actually, a member came up with an idea to create a platform where we could host. Well, people could add objects and other people could borrow them for free. And so we built out a platform. We call it the Library of Things. We invested some money into buying items, catalogued the items, and now have them online. And so we've now got, you know, 250 plus objects / items that people can borrow for free if they live in Old Oak. And they range from fancy dress outfits, a tent, a suitcase, cocktail making kits, kayaks, whatever. You can just log in and say, I want to borrow the suitcase for a week. And I think why this is such an interesting technology or approach is because it really embodies why I think co-living exists, which is people don't want to own that much. This concept of ownership, especially in housing, is so British. But it's also a massive hindrance to lifestyle, I think, too, given that people are much more willing to spend money on experiences. So rather than me going and spending 100 quid on a suitcase I use for 1 week a year, the collective spent 100 pounds on a suitcase and it gets used for 52 weeks of the year. And the implications of that are huge for individuals' experience, but also for society. You know,
right.
the decrease in consumption and no longer needing to mass produce items, I think, is very, very interesting. So to kind of circle up on that question, there's a company that's just been backed by Y Combinator that I think is one to watch called Fat Llama. And they have a platform where anyone in London can upload any of their items and you can rent them for the day. And it's an opportunity for you to get money, sort of an income from an item that you perhaps use once a month or once a year. I think it's genius. And I think that's the way we're going to go as a society and as a world.
the sharing economy coming to us far more quickly than we might anticipate.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much. It's really interesting speaking to someone who's actually on the ground doing the community building, or as we found out, maybe not necessarily just enabling the community building. But thank you, Ed. It's been a pleasure, and best of luck with the new scheme.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
I feel surprisingly encouraged after speaking to Ed. I think I'd gone into the interview with a preconception that there'd be a slightly worthy tint to what he was trying to achieve. What I learned, however, couldn't have been any further removed from that perception. Firstly, it's clear that the collective attach a genuine importance to the concept of community. They see it as a clear brand point of difference in what is likely to become an increasingly competitive market. It's a necessity and not just a soft marketing point. Secondly, Ed is incredibly thoughtful about how this sense of community is built. There is no one-size-fits-all solution, and I think it's clear from Ed that he thinks the property owner or manager's role isn't to build community, but to put the tools in place to enable the community to grow organically. Again, this can sound all quite fluffy, but the point is that the way in which this might evolve will ultimately depend on the individuals within it. So to that extent, good design, enabling technology, and careful on-site management all play a part in ensuring high levels of interaction from which community can naturally develop. Now, if like me, you're somewhat skeptical of anything with so much of a tinge of forced fun, this is refreshing news. Ed clearly sees the need for individuality and not pushing anything onto any of their members. Clearly, however, there's a difference between facilitation and simply taking a back seat in the process. And so the skill lies in plotting the path between these two courses of action. Ed and the collective are clearly some way ahead of the crowd in this kind of thinking to date. The question now is whether or not others will follow their lead if a promise of higher customer happiness, retention rates, and ultimately rental levels can be borne out. Please join me next week when I'll be exploring the future of convenience retail with Mark Robinson of Alandi. Remember to look out for me on Twitter. Again, the handle is @building_r. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time on Building Our Future. Well, look, thank you very much for inviting me over and for giving up your time to speak to us. It's been fascinating.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
Shane argues that music is the only universal language and is part of most people's lives, from early education through to the healthy aging process. It's a simple, cost-effective way of bringing people together and therefore key to helping to build communities. In the space-as-a-service age, this should really be grabbing property owners' attention. From a civic perspective, as our cities enlarge, competing for human capital and resources, music can not only be a driver of growth and in attracting talent, but also a key tool in solving the crisis of loneliness. Now, due to land value issues, music needs to be integrated into the master planning stage of development in order to be properly effective. Shane believes that for this to happen, cities and authorities need a coherent music policy and an internal music officer who can promote the cause and liaise with planning, hospitality, and transport departments to ensure that policy intentions are actually delivered. Sound Diplomacy have witnessed firsthand the efficacy of this approach via the creation of London's Night Czar. Developers are all selling through culture to some extent, and music can be yet another string to their bow. However, while data can now demonstrate the value of music over time, demonstrating short-term return on capital does remain an issue. A successful music policy will have to encompass the full music infrastructure, from large venues through to grassroots. Shane suggests that for venues with capacity of less than 500 to be viable, mixed-use options should be explored. And I'm sure that tech-enabled solutions, such as Vanessa Butz's District, can play a role in enabling this duality of buildings. I'll be back next week with a new episode, so please join me as I discuss the transport systems of the future and how we can use technology to deliver major infrastructure projects in a more collaborative and timely manner. Finally, as a small favour and just for a few moments of your time, please do rate or review the show on Apple Podcasts, or just like or share the episode-related articles that I'll post on LinkedIn. It really is the best way of getting out our message to the widest community possible, and I'd really appreciate it if you could take the time. Thank you again, and I hope you'll join me next week on Building Our Future.